Night gathers, and now my rewatch begins.
Welcome back to Oysters, Clams, and Cockles, the number one Game of Thrones podcast in the realm for people who party like Tyrion and slay like Daenerys, brought to you by Grand X Media. I am Ross Bolin, here at the Grand X Media Studios in Austin, Texas, with my co-host, Barrett Dudley.
Oh man, it's good to be here, just to sit with Ross and talk about this wonderful episode of Game of Thrones. And, you know, people have said that we're really great at providing just amazing insight into these episodes.
People have said that. Yeah. I've heard this. Have you heard this?
That's what I've been hearing. Well, yeah. Guess what? I provide really, really good insight on another topic. It's style and fashion.
Oh, do you?
Yes. Make sure you're also giving a chance to my other podcast, Club Cool.
Yes.
On Grand X Labs. You can even follow the Instagram account at Club Cool Pod.
Club Cool.
At Club Cool Pod on Instagram. Check out the podcast on Grand X Labs. You've been on two of them now.
I have.
Two out of the four. You're going 50%.
I had great fun.
Yeah.
Thoroughly enjoyed myself.
The last one has a bunch of guests. It's a round table. We talk about a whole bunch of stuff. It's a lot of fun, but if you like the insight that I provide here, you might like the insight that I provide elsewhere as
Barrett,
well.
What you're telling us is that there's more Barrett insight to be had.
That is true.
On another podcast.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Called Club Cool.
Yep.
Great. Subscribe to Grand X Labs. You'll get every episode of Club Cool right when it drops. It's fantastic. Barrett's doing a really fun show with style and fashion and pop culture and such. Maybe one day he'll even mention Wilmer Valderrama. I don't know.
You never know. Bring up the Cash Monies on that podcast,
you could,
too.
You could.
Speaking of pop culture, though, this episode, and pivoting back to the Game of Thrones.
Okay.
This episode looms large in 2015 pop culture. People were not happy about this shit.
No, well, it's pretty disturbing.
Yeah.
It's not fun, but we're going to talk about it anyway. Because this is the Night's Rewatch, and that's what we do. We do a podcast for every episode of Game of Thrones, starting with season one, episode one, leading up to the final season of our favorite show, so we can all be as prepared as possible. We recommend you take the black and join us. Tell your coworkers, family members, friends, neighbors, anyone who likes Game of Thrones, tell them. Hey, there's a podcast out there. It's called Oysters, Clams, and Cockles. You'll probably enjoy it. They talk about Game of Thrones and make pop culture references, such as Wilmer Valderrama's The Cash Monies. I can't say his name anymore. I say Wilder. It's Wilmer.
Wilmer from MTV's hit show, Yo Mama.
Yo Mama. The worst running joke.
I hear they're bringing back Yo Mama.
No, they're not.
Yeah, they're doing a reboot. They're rebooting it.
You didn't hear that.
Everybody, everything's getting a reboot these days.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think that one is. I don't think that one is. Hey, we've got a hotline number. It's 866-43-CLAMS. 866-43-CLAMS. CLAMS, as in oysters, clams, and cockles. You can call that number at any time. It's a voicemail. You can leave questions, takes, theories, whatever you want. The hotline is there at your disposal. We have pulled three calls to play this week. Quickly, before we dive into our episode, here is the first one.
Yo, what's up, guys? It's Kyle from Texas. This week, y'all are talking about who the best secondary kind of supporting character might be, and y'all kind of agreed on Tormund. But I feel like you gotta throw Bronn into that conversation. Maybe even the Hound, but Bronn especially. I mean, that dude is involved in some of the hands-down funniest scenes in the show, plus also being a badass. Also, his buddy cop duo relationship with some of the other characters is pretty great. especially Tyrion. So yeah, I did give a shout out to that guy. The Hound's a good secondary runner up. Dorman's a badass too, don't get me wrong. But yeah, I had to give a shout out to those guys. Love the podcast though. Keep doing what y'all are doing. Peace.
So we got a lot of calls, a number of calls from upset Thrones fans because we didn't mention Bronn.
Yeah, yeah.
And we were upset with ourselves too, but we were on a Tormund tip at the moment.
We were big on Tormund after the last episode.
Yeah.
And also, the more that we incite our fans, the more engagement there is, and that's what we like.
Are you saying we piss people off on purpose?
Not on purpose.
Oh.
But if we get a conversation going,
right.
That's wonderful.
Right.
Did you hear this over the last week? Game of Thrones is coming out first half of 2019.
Yes, that's exciting news.
Now, nobody knows what that means.
No.
Yet, but it means it will premiere at some point between January
and June. Huh.
But them saying first half kind of indicates that it feels like it indicates that it won't be
at the beginning.
Summer.
Right. Oh, okay.
That it will be possibly, you think it'll be like their usual March, April time.
Oh.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
That would be cool.
Anyways, we're probably going to finish our rewatch and have a little bit of time to go. So I was thinking maybe if you guys, you can give us some feedback and let us know if this is something that you'd want. But, you know, episodes that are just totally devoted to power ranking the secondary characters, like that. Yeah. I mean, and there's a bunch of ideas that
power
we can,
ranking the buddy cop duo.
Sure, but there's a lot that we can kind of spin around with and talk about. And I think that's after yes, absolutely, I agree with the call. Bronn and the Hound, both very high up there. You, of course, me, I rides for my man's Jorah. There's a lot to talk about there.
Yeah, look, in hindsight, it's very difficult to pick a supporting secondary character as a overall favorite. It just is. It depends on what part of the show you're in. Bronn, the Hound, Tormund, they're all fantastic. I'd say up through season 4, Bronn is probably the clear cut. I don't know though, the Hound is right there. It's just kind of Bronn is like peaking in coolness in 3 and 4. It's hard. But I thank you for calling in and bringing attention to Bronn and the Hound.
Indeed.
Both very deserving of our conversation. Next call.
What's up, guys? Reese from Houston. I'm just watching YouTube, and I see a trailer for this new movie, Godzilla, King of the Monsters. So I guess it's maybe the follow-up of the first Godzilla. And about, like, I don't know, all the way through, maybe like 15 seconds left, Tywin Lannister pops up. There's no cameo in the entire trailer until just like 15 seconds left. And all he says is long live the king. And I'm like, they just have that in there solely based on the fact that he was in Game of Thrones. Just wanted to throw that out to you. You guys maybe look it up and see it. I laugh pretty hard. It's the only thing he says. And for sure, maybe the only thing he says in the entire movie. But I love the pod. Keep it really good work, boys. See you guys.
So the guy who plays Tywin.
Charles Dance
is in the new Godzilla movie.
He is.
And they utilize him in the trailer with one line. Long live the king.
Yeah. The hype is real around that movie. It's got Millie Bobby. It's starring Millie Bobby Brown.
Oh, shit.
So, and then.
Yes,
it is a sequel to the most recent Godzilla, which I think had Bryan Cranston in it.
It did, for a very short period of time.
And I didn't actually see that one.
Although I heard it was. I saw it in theaters.
Pretty good.
It was good.
It was okay.
It was fun.
That's okay.
I enjoyed it.
Okay. And it also had Elizabeth Olsen in it, I think.
Those two
are not coming back, but there are a couple of characters coming back from the first one. They added Millie Bobby Brown. They add Charles Dance. They got some of the old Godzilla faves coming back, like Mothra.
Really?
Yeah, it looks pretty interesting.
King of the Monsters, 2019. Yeah, I don't know. It's kind of funny that they've got Tywin in the trailer saying long live the king, though.
Yes.
It's just kind of a shameless pull at Thrones fans.
Right.
Anyway, good bit of information.
It worked. I like Charles Dance.
Yeah. Last and final call.
Hey, guys. This is Jessica calling from Virginia. Just listening to your latest episode, and you were talking about Roose Bolton getting stuck with Fat Walder Frey, but actually, Roose chose her because Walder told him that he would pay the weight of the bride in gold, I believe, or whatever currency. I'm not quite sure if it was gold. But basically, Roose chose her because he was going to get the most out of it for picking the fattest one. So that's it. Love you guys. Bye.
That's kind of all you need to know about Roose Bolton, like as a whole.
I don't remember us saying that he got stuck with the fat one. I mean, I knew that. I knew that why he chose her.
I think I was fat shaming her, and in somehow throughout that process, I was just like, how'd he end up?
Fat shaming her. Ramsey was fat shaming her.
Right.
He kept making all the fat jokes.
I was just saying the things Ramsey said, and vicariously, I was fat shaming.
Okay.
But the point is, this is just an incredible bit of information in history about Roose and why he chose Fat Walda, because he was paid per pound of wife. And that just tells you that he doesn't care at all about her. It was just about monetary gain. And that's next level. Like, if you're in that situation, if you're Roose Bolton and you're told, look, you got to pick one of my daughters to marry. That's part of this deal. And I'm going to help you kill off all the Starks.
Mm-hmm.
And here's a caveat. I will pay you X amount of gold dragons based on how much she weighs.
Yeah.
The more weight, the more dragons you get.
Yes.
Do you pick the fattest one?
No, I'm still personally going to pick the hottest one.
Yeah, he's crazy here. This is crazy.
Now, if there are two that I find equally attractive and one is like
10 pounds more,
kind of slim thick, and the other is very slender,
hell yeah,
maybe I'll go with the slim thick.
Dude, you always go slim thick, in my opinion. It's more in 2018.
True. As is being paid to take Zipper's daughter as a wife, obviously.
Yes,
so, you
very
know,
much.
Totally realistic situation that we're talking about
absolutely.
Here.
Yeah, no, I go with the hottest one. And here's the problem. The hottest one is taken by that doofus.
That's right.
And all the other ones are wretched.
When he lucked out for like 10 minutes.
So you have to understand Ruse's perspective here. The hot one is taken. The rest of them look like different variations of witch that you would find in the forest somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the fat one. Come on, you're looking down that line. We saw the lineup of all the daughters. This is a terrible choice to have to make. But if you see Fat Wald at the end of that line, you know you have to go with her. Because that's the big bag of money. You have to. And you can't blame him. Anyway, just a good bit of info. Thank you for calling and shedding some light on that very tasteful, unoffensive matter. Let's get into Season 5, Episode 6. This one is titled Unbowed, Unbent, Unbroken. It's written by the Cogman. And directed by Jeremy Potiswa, who officially just went back-to-back. Both of them did. What an incredible feat.
Yeah, it really was.
The episode opens up in the House of Black and White, with Arya cleaning a corpse. She's wiping it down, washing the hair, covering it up. All of this little beginning here, it kind of just shows you how intimate Arya is having to get with dead bodies, right? This is a lot of time she's spending with dead bodies, and I don't think they could totally do it justice through one of these little, like, you know, supercut scenes or whatever. But you need to take that away from this. She's cleaning a lot of dead people, and she's a child. I don't know if any of you have ever, you know, played with a corpse. Having done so myself, it is not something you want to do. It's not enjoyable. I once found a dead guy in a parking lot. That's a true story. But point is, she's around a lot of dead bodies.
Yeah,
so
this whole thing, I ended up doing a few kind of deep dives on various aspects of the episode this week. But this one, you know, I just began to scratch the surface because I just don't know what old George was thinking with the whole thing. Like, how did he, what are they cleaning the, I don't understand why they got to clean the bodies.
It's
why
weird.
Was he like, they need to clean the bodies. What is happening?
Yeah,
here?
It's awkward because it's the element of mystery to the House of Black and White within the books works better than it does in the show, but it's still not great. Like, you're still like, this is really weird, and it's just there's too much mystery to it.
And it would make sense if you have to clean the face so you can wear the face.
Some explanation.
Maybe you technically kind of wear the whole body. I don't know.
Nobody knows, though. That's the problem.
Yeah, okay.
That we went through the whole season and nobody fucking knows.
Yeah.
Look, here's what we do know. She has to clean the thing, right? They clean every one of these bodies that comes through. Nobody knows to what purpose. But after they're cleaned, these bodies are taken away through a door. And nobody knows what's on the other side. We don't know what's on the other side of that door yet at this point in the episode. The waif won't tell Arya, won't let her follow through the door, and Arya's pissed. She's been scrubbing corpses for weeks. And she's like, when the hell can I, you know, take the next step here? I want to get initiated, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And the waif is like, when it's time, not before. Which is a terrible answer. If I say, you know, when are we going to be there? Or like, hey, when are we going to get that project finished? And somebody's answer is, when it's time, not before, we're fighting. That's a dick answer.
It is. It is.
Arya then is like, well, let's play the game of faces. When do I get to play the game of faces again? And the waif, you know, she finds this to be humorous because she knows Arya's not ready, whatever the fuck that means. And she says, who are you? And Arya says, no one. And she's like, get back to work. How did she fail there? She could just tell her no one wasn't genuine
enough?
Yes. That's so fucking stupid. And Arya's like, well, who are you? Where are you from? And the waif tells her this long, drawn-out story about how she was heir to a fortune. Her father was a lord, just like Arya's, blah, 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 blah. And then before Arya can even respond, she's like, was that true or a lie? Did you believe every word I said? Get back to work again. And it's like,
okay,
this game sucks.
Yeah. So this is part of what I was looking up. And the game of faces partially doesn't have to do with the faces. It's about lying.
Yeah, but that's super simple.
And about saying truths along with... You ever played Two Truths and a Lie?
Yes.
That's what it is.
That's basically the whole game.
That is the whole game.
I'm saying that's too simple for it to be shrouded in mystery. Like, they're acting like it's this special thing, but really it's just...
But really you just have to learn how to lie real good?
Play make-believe.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. I listened to the waif tell that story, and then I was like, okay.
That's the thing. You can kind of put it together, right? You get the idea. It's like, okay, this involves lying somehow, and it's like whether or not other people can tell you're lying, pretending to become someone else. Acting is really what you're doing.
Yes, and so I'm trying to put that together with the whole no one thing, and I think they go hand in hand because more pop culture references here. As George Costanza says, if you believe it, it's not a lie. And
I love that line.
And so I think that's kind of what they're like pushing these people towards is if you are no one, if you believe that you are a completely blank canvas, then anything you say can be a truth.
And so the waif and Jock and Agar are just like human lie detectors, like Robert De Niro and Meet the Parents.
Yes. Yeah.
For pop culture reference purposes.
Uh-huh.
That's just, it's so idiotic. Whatever. This is where the whole thing falters. This whole storyline, in my opinion, kind of falls apart because the game of faces is so weird. It's not well explained. It's just never explained.
It's not
period.
Really. Yeah.
And
they definitely just leave it all kind of up in the air and you go decipher it.
That would be cool if the payoff was there, but it's not.
Yeah.
It never is. Anyway, so later that night, when Arya lays down on her concrete slab of a bed, Jock and Agar visits her and asks her again, Who are you? And Arya says, Arya. He says, where did you come from? She says, Westeros. And she goes on to start to tell her life story with little lies mixed in. Like that her dad was killed in battle. He obviously wasn't. He was beheaded. Every time she says a lie, Jockin strikes her with a stick. One of the other lies she says is that she killed her first boy by stabbing him in the back. She stabbed him in the gut, obviously. So she keeps telling the truth after she gets smacked. But the other one is she says she hated the Hound. And he hits her and she's like, I did hate him. And she hits him again, or he hits her again. And she's like, that's not a lie. And he disagrees. It gets even more confusing there. It's just like, wait, what? Like, wouldn't she know if she really... she's lying to herself.
She's lying to herself, yeah.
That's so fucking dumb, though.
Because she does... Because we know that she formed a bond with the Hound.
Right. How does he know, though?
Because he's...
He's magic.
Yeah.
Whatever. He asks her if she wants to be no one. She says yes, and he hits her again. And then she's like, I'm not playing this stupid game anymore. And he says, we never stop playing. And at that point, I would have been like, I'm fucking out. Because that game's terrible. And if we never stop playing...
Well, and now I'm just really reading into everything. So right. I'm reading into this initial, do you really, really want to be no one? And man, it seems like she does, but at the same time, it feels like a thing that we know kind of already that she can't ever really let go of this.
Right. Like that's the part that makes it's not the part. There's several parts.
And then his response that we never stop playing also kind of feels like it adds to the whole thing of where like maybe you're not really ever supposed to be no one. Maybe that's just another thing that you learned to lie about. I don't know.
Yeah. It's very confusing. But I do know this. If you are Arya in this situation, in the House of Black and White, you have to bring up Lisa mattresses to Jack and Agar. Sleeping on a concrete slab, that's simply unacceptable. Sleep is far too important for a concrete slab to be your bed. Jockin should know that. And it's very simple. As a member of the Clam Fam or a brother or sister in the Night's Rewatch, Jock and Agar, Arya, either one of them, could go to lisa.com/dragon.
Dragon.
LEESA.com/dragon.
Dragon.
And get $160 off a Lisa mattress right now. That's the best mattress in all the Seven Kingdoms or Essos or anywhere.
Or the United States of America.
Or Russia. Or China. Anywhere. Anywhere. You cannot get a better mattress. $160 off. Sleep is important. Helps you recover from distractions. It prevents burnout. You make better decisions. You'll improve your memory. You'll be better at playing the game of faces. And to design a better mattress, Lisa leveraged 30 plus years of experience and hundreds of hours of testing and science to develop the perfect mattress for all body shapes and sleeping styles. Their mission is to provide a better night's sleep for everybody through their 110 program. They donate one mattress for every 10 they sell. They've donated over 26,000 mattresses and counting. They strive to leave the world a better place than they found it, and that doesn't stop with mattress donations. Together with the Arbor Day Foundation, Lisa plants one tree for every mattress they sell, and they have committed to planting 1 million trees by 2025. Do not miss out on these summer savings. Do not sleep on a concrete slab like Arya. Don't be a fool like Jockin. Get your Lisa mattress today from lisa.com/dragon.
Dragon.
$160 off just for being a listener. Fantastic stuff. Now on the road with Tyrion and Jorah. Apparently some people's least favorite buddy cop duo.
But they start to get the band. They
get a little better here.
This episode, you start to get that type of buddy cop back and forth.
Jorah opens up a little more.
Right.
When he starts to talk a little more, it gets better.
When somebody's always annoyed in a buddy cop duo, that's part of it. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Brienne, constantly annoyed by Pod. Anyway, they didn't find these fishing villages that Jorah was looking for, and Tyrion is concerned about how they're going to live on berries and roots. At one point, Tyrion actually says, "You're an awful traveling companion. Do you know that? Possibly the least charming man I've ever met," which is quite the insult. They get to talking. Jorah finally asks Tyrion why he was where he was when Jorah found him, and Tyrion tells the story of how he killed his father, how Tywin, his father, was fucking the woman he loved. So Jorah gets a little bit of insight here into Tyrion, why he is where he is, everything that's going on with him and his own personal story. Then Tyrion says, "As miserable as you are, Mormont, at least your father was a good man." And he tells Jorah about how he met Lord Commander Jeor Mormont, Jorah's father, at the Wall. And he caps that story off by saying, "And how do they put it in the Watch? We shall never see his like again." And unintentionally, totally accidentally here, Tyrion informs Jorah that his father is dead, that he was killed. It's kind of brutal. Jorah asks how, and Tyrion tells him what he heard, that he was leading an expedition beyond the Wall, and there was a mutiny, he was murdered by his own men, and Jorah's clearly upset, you know, but his face doesn't falter much, there's not a ton of emotion there, but you can see.
Pretty stoic guy, that one.
It's his pops, you know, he's finding out, this is bad news, this is a sad moment for him, and his response is, "We better keep moving," and that's that. Kind of a bummer, though, it's a weak-ass way to find out your father's Gonski.
Mm-hmm.
Back at the House of Black and White again, because hey, why not? Arya is scrubbing floors in the lobby when a man brings in his sick daughter. He lays her down by the well and approaches Arya. He says, "I have nowhere else to go. I've taken her to every healer in Braavos. I've spent every penny I have. She suffers every day of her life. I just want it to end." This is a very, like, Dr. Death situation here. His daughter's suffering. She's got some fatal illness or untreatable disease. And he wants her to to stop suffering. He wants them to help her be dead. So Arya goes over to the little girl, and the little girl's like, it hurts. And Arya's like, I know. Don't be afraid. I used to be like you. I was sick. I was dying. But my father, he never gave up on me. He loved me more than anything in the world, just like your father loves you. So he brought me here. My father prayed to the many-faced god, and I drank the water from his fountain. It healed me. Then she scoops up a little bowl of water from the well and says, I've devoted my life to him now. You don't want to hurt anymore. Drink. And she feeds the girl the death water, whatever this is, yeah, that kills you.
Right.
Wait, you got any deep dive information on what the fuck this, why she just murdered this child?
No, I have no clue. I guess this is one instance where you need the lying skills so that you can convince people to die by lying to them.
See, it's the element of getting it a little bit. You're like, okay, she's utilizing the lying thing. She's telling this lie about how she was also sick and her dad brought her here and she drank from this well and it healed her. She's lying to get the girl to drink from the well. But why? Like, what's the greater reasoning? And I know our fucking hotline is just going to go apeshit with people trying to explain the House of Black and White because it's just destined to happen. But oh my God. Well, and Luke is rolling his eyes because he has to listen to all the calls. But this is just, it didn't go down the way it could have. None of this got explained in a way that makes you like, oh, none of the moments that were supposed to be aha moments actually are.
Yeah. And then it's also weird because, like you just kind of alluded to, she's kind of murdering this girl in a way. Her dad wants her to,
I mean, not
the
in
suffering
a way,
to end.
She kills the girl. It's fucking
then
weird. It's
the
weird.
Girl maybe doesn't want to die. I don't know. Or does she? Is this just a story that she needs to hear?
I don't know. But she dies.
Yeah. But
oh, she dies. Because we flash forward, like, who knows, 5 minutes maybe. And Arya's cleaning that girl's corpse, washing it down, wiping it off. And then apparently, the overlying message that I get here is that Arya has done something right. Because Jaqen approaches her. He opens the door that she's been curious to venture through, and he leaves it open and, like, kind of mysterious. I mean, he, without actually being like, hey, follow me.
Because nobody in the House of Black and White says anything like that. They just
leave a door open
they
and
just
they walk off.
Right, uh-huh.
And then you know, okay, I have to follow that person.
Or look at you, and you know you're supposed to help clean the body.
Right. Yeah, there's no actual communication. And no verbal communication, rather. Anyway, so she follows him. And he leads her down through these hallways and through another door. And then for the first time ever, we see the Hall of Many Faces. There's hundreds.
All of the faces.
Of lifelike human faces adorning these walls all over the pillars. This spooky House of Black and White music is playing as Arya, like, walks around and takes it all in, looking at the faces. And again, it's as if this moment is supposed to give you some kind of like, oh, but not really. And then Jaqen asks, is a girl ready to give up her ears, her nose, her tongue, her hopes and dreams, her loves and hates, all that makes a girl who she is, forever? And then before Arya can answer, he says, no, a girl is not ready to become no one, but she is ready to become someone else.
Mm.
End confusing scene. No explanation on that either.
Okay, all right. So here's how I'm going to take this one.
Okay.
She's good enough at the lying, and she's ready to become assassin level, obviously,
uh-huh,
for the House of Black and White.
Okay.
That's all that we really need Arya to be.
Right.
Is assassin House of Black and White.
Yes.
So
we don't need to be a priest.
Maybe there is like this other higher level of quote unquote being no one that she's never meant to attain. Because he's obviously going to let her go do stuff even though she's not no one right now.
Right.
You can be someone. You're not no one, but you can be someone.
Yeah.
So
it's very frustrating. And it's all like, it's a lot of my frustration comes from how mysterious and cool the setting is and how the story doesn't live up to it, basically.
Well, and the biggest bummer for me was how awesome Jaqen was in season 3.
Like, arguably 2, 3. Arguably one of the coolest characters on the show during that time period.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And like, then now you're just annoyed by the dude for a little while.
Yeah, and then, the way in which they kind of fail these aha moments and the backstory of the House in Black and White and don't really give you like a great explanation or anything that like makes sense as a viewer you know, it takes away from how cool he was at first.
Yeah, I mean, so. I hope to God that we get some type of Jockin involvement in season 8. I don't think that's going to happen.
I don't think he will. Uh-uh.
And if you think about it in terms of just his character's arc, he was like shooting up the stock market.
Yes.
And then we find him at the House of Black and White, and he kind of like fucking, you know, evens out.
Right.
And then he just plummets. And then he never gets to come. Like, dude, he never gets to do anything cool again.
Mm-hmm.
This all becomes about Arya and the Waif. And I'm with you. It's just a total waste of Jockin and the momentum that they had built up with him. And that's another big frustrating part of the whole thing. Anyway, let's get the hell out of there. Back on the road with Tyrion and Jorah. We just bounce back and forth from these two places for the first 20, 30 minutes of the show. It's kind of weird if you didn't notice that. Anyway, Tyrion's now wants to know more about why Daenerys? Why is she worth all this? He says, as I recall, the Mormonts fought against the Targaryens during Robert's Rebellion. And Jorah explains that he believes in something greater than himself, that he didn't used to believe in that or anything, that he was a cynic just like Tyrion, but then he saw Dany step into the fire on the funeral pyre of pier of Khal Drogo with 3 stone eggs, and when the fire burned away, she was there with 3 baby dragons. He doesn't mention, I don't think, her breasts specifically, but we were all thinking about him. Tyrion is like, that doesn't mean she's going to be a great queen, which is a really good point. I'm glad finally somebody says this. And Jorah's like, no, it doesn't. Tyrion says the Targaryens are famously insane. What if she conquers the world? Then what? 1,000 years of peace and prosperity? Jorah's like, first we have to conquer the world. And Tyrion's like, we? He then calls into question Jorah's whole plan to bring Tyrion to Dany to win back her affection. And then she takes the throne. And then what? He's just prodding at Jorah here, trying to get more information out of him. He says, so a woman who has not spent a single day of her adult life in Westeros becomes the ruler of Westeros? That's justice? And Jorah's like, she's the rightful heir. Tyrion's like, why? Because her father, who burned living men for amusement, was the king? This whole scene is just ripping away at the concept of the wheel, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And little does Tyrion know that she very much intends on breaking that wheel. I don't think she's announced that yet. And he's just kind of trying to make sure, like, hey, man, if we're all going to get behind this chick, are we doing it for the right reasons, or are we doing it because she's just the blood heir
of
mm-hmm. some lunatic
right.
that murdered people, whatever? Before they can really finish the conversation, though, Jorah grabs Tyrion suddenly and like pulls him into cover because he spots a slave ship, and he's about to say, these slavers probably came ashore for water, when the slaver behind them finishes a sentence for him. They beat Jorah in an attempt to get information out of him, but Jorah, you know, he's a steel trap. Dude's not giving anything up. He doesn't say shit.
And well, you know, well, not snitches, snitches get stitches.
They do.
Yeah.
They do. Slavers discuss where Jorah and Tyrion should be sent. For Jorah, they discuss the salt mines, or he could just become a galley slave. But for the dwarf, they're like, oh, he's worthless. Cut his throat and then chop off his cock, they say. They say a dwarf's cock has magic powers, which is a lovely little...
I hadn't heard that before.
Urban legend,
but
in Westerosi lore.
Essos, Atlantis.
Essos,
the whole,
yeah, whatever.
The whole,
everywhere.
The whole shebang. The whole kit and caboodle.
Tyrion's like,
whoa. They all believe that.
Don't. Let's discuss this. Let's not just cut off my penis. You need proof that it's a dwarf's cock. They're talking about who they're going to sell it to. He's like, how could he know unless he sees the dwarf? And the slaver's like, it'll be a dwarf-sized cock. And Tyrion says, guess again.
The guess again line is really good.
Yeah, it's good. He's saying his meat is if at least a sufficient size.
No, that of a normal-sized man.
Perhaps larger.
Yeah.
That's the implication.
Who's to say? We may never know.
We may never know. Anyway, the head slaver says, the dwarf lives until we find a cock merchant. And it got me thinking about what you would have to do for that to become your line of work.
Mm.
And how weird of a profession that is. Like when you're at the pub or the brothel or mm-hmm. whatever, and you're sitting next to some other guy and you guys get to talking and he's like, so what do you do for a living? Do you say cock merchant?
I guess. It's probably like if you're the owner of some strip clubs, you don't just come right out and say that.
Okay.
You say that you're like a small business owner and then you start feeling it out. Oh, right. Well, I own some, you know, I own a few places. Yeah, you know, they're dance halls.
Sure, they have poles in them.
You just kind of work up to what they actually are. So
gotcha.
He probably just starts with that he's just like a merchant. He's got a few ships. He deals in some niche
organs, organ market.
Trading. The niche, and some niche markets, some niche organ markets.
Cock merchant. What a name for a job. We find out the slavers are headed for Volantis, blah, blah, blah. Danny has opened up the fighting pits in Marine. And when Tyrion hears that, he jumps at the opportunity to inflate their value by telling the slavers all about Jorah and his legendary status as a warrior, how he's the veteran of hundreds of battles, how he unseated Jaime Lannister in some tournament. And they laugh at that last part, saying jousting is a fancy game for fancy lads and that the men in Marine will swallow him whole, which is very funny. But Jorah speaks up. He says, I killed a Dothraki blood rider in single combat. And I don't know why, but that's the dorkiest thing I've ever heard anyone say. I had to pause it because I was laughing. Like, no one would ever be that specific. I killed a Dothraki blood rider in single combat.
It does sound like something that like a video, like an esports person would say about, I don't play Fortnite.
Yeah, that is, like about World of Warcraft or something.
Yeah.
Anyway, the guy's like, this is a very serious thing that Jorah said. He like jumps over a piece of wood or something and like gets right in Jorah's face and he's like, liar. Jorah's like, it's no lie. His name was Quotho. He was blood rider to Khal Drogo. Again, just next level dorky shit here. He says, take me to Slaver's Bay, put a sword in my hand, I'll prove my worth. The guy's name was Quotho. Q-O-T-H-O was his name.
Yeah, no, you're right. This little scene taken out of context would be incredibly dorky. nerdy and dorky. And the lines pretty silly. And like my notes are just like, I mean, did just all slavers love the fighting pits, I guess? Is that the implication here? They're so lucky that these guys are like going to take time out of their busy pirating, slaving line of work to go run a fighting pit ring now. They got to run this guy into the fighting pits to make some money.
That's going to take time off
their ship. They got to get off the ship to do that.
Right. I think basically how it works is they take Jorah to Marine and they sell him as an accomplished fighter to someone who runs one of these teams or whatever. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But regardless, that does the trick, it seems. This slaver laughs, but you get the feeling he's like, all right, let's see what you've got, old man. And that's basically the end of the scene.
Yeah, okay. All right.
Back in King's Landing, Peter Baelish is sneaking around. He is back. And he gets approached by one of the Sparrows with a group, led by Lancel Lannister, of course. Brother Lancel. He says they abandon their family names, and Littlefinger says, quite a family to abandon, which is a good line. Lancel goes on to explain to Littlefinger that the city has changed since he was last there, that the Sparrows have sent the godless on the run, they've dumped all the wine into the gutters and shut down the whorehouses, and they're running out all these heathens. Littlefinger's response to that is, well done. And then he tries to walk off, and anyway, there's like almost a confrontation, but basically the message is this. Lancel says, step carefully, Lord Baelish. You'll find there's little tolerance for flesh peddlers in the new King's Landing. All of this is just a build-up to give Littlefinger the chance to take a shot at religion. He says, we both peddle fantasies, Brother Lancel. Mine just happened to be entertaining, which is a good shot at religion. It is. If you're Littlefinger, which after this statement you have to presume, atheist, and you run whorehouses, at least you believe your fantasies to be like fulfilling on some level, like people are getting a bone, right?
Yeah.
And they're entertaining.
Yes.
So he's Lancel, all he gets to do is carve a star into his head and go around punishing people for breaking rules.
Yeah, as awesome as the sept blow up is, I really wished that a few of these guys had gotten whacked the old school way.
In some sort of fighting?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's weird. I feel like we get a little bit at
one point.
The mountain maybe takes out a couple of them.
Okay, maybe so.
But it's short-lived.
Yeah.
These guys are annoying as fuck. This whole episode is a frustrating one. If you don't always listen to our show, it is normally very positive. I'm just kind of in a mood here, all right? I'm gonna rip on it a little bit. Give me this. Next, Littlefinger meets with Cersei. He questions the idea of her arresting the heir to Highgarden, Loras. Cersei tries to spin the whole thing that she's the insulted party, not the Tyrells, because Loras was promised to her and instead chose the company of boys. Littlefinger mocks her by saying one's choice of companion is a curious thing.
Great zing.
Cersei says, most curious.
Roasted.
Boom, roasted. Lysa Arryn, for instance, a thoroughly repellent woman. Forgive me, I know you're still in mourning. Eventually, after Cersei's involved in quite a few conversations in this episode that are really just biting remarks back and forth.
Just playing tennis, just slapping it back and forth.
Love it. Slap it around. Then she cuts to the chase and she asks Littlefinger, point blank, if war comes to Westeros, will the Knights of the Vale fight for their king? And Littlefinger gives her a roundabout yes. He says, Lord Robin heeds his advice and he has always counseled loyalty to the throne. So I take it as this. Yes, if you don't fuck me. But if you fuck me, certainly you won't have the veil and you won't have the Knights of the Veil.
Yep.
Which is important. He then goes on to tell her, Cersei, that he failed in finding Arya Stark, but he did find Sansa Stark, alive and home again, living in Winterfell. Cersei, shocked by this, says it's not possible. Littlefinger updates her on all the ongoings with Sansa's impending wedding to Roose Bolton.
Love watching this guy play the game, though. Oh, I have located, I know where Sansa Stark is.
Yes.
Just the whole, like, I've found her from my sources, and I know when where really she is. He's like, that was, you know.
I meant Ramsay Bolton, by the way. But yeah, it's interesting to me that Cersei, someone who has as many little birds as she does and that gets the information she does, would have gotten no information about the fact that Littlefinger was gallivanting around with Sansa. But then you have to remember, she was in disguise.
And he was very careful to make sure that he was not connected to her escape from King's Landing, and then that she was not Sansa Stark while she was in the Vale.
Yeah.
And then he only had a very small number of people that he was paying very well transport them to Winterfell.
And that is how this whole thing worked. And it's why he had to be so careful and secretive, is because all along he intended on approaching Cersei with this information. And
I mean, this man is playing every single side he can think of, and it's incredible.
It's pretty beautiful, really. He's so many steps ahead on the board than you even realize as a viewer. It's just nuts. But anyway, Cersei very, very, very angry when she finds out that Roose plans on marrying Sansa to his bastard Ramsay. She says she's going to skin both of them alive like that wretch on their bloody sigil. And Littlefinger's like, well, now, don't do that. I advise patience. He basically is like, look, these two morons, Stannis and Roose Bolton, they're going to end up fighting. Mm-hmm. That's what's about to happen. You need to let them duke it out. And then when they're done, seize Winterfell from whichever thief survives while the victor licks his wounds. Basically, he's like, look, let them take some of their own men out.
Right.
We'll go in after the fact and clean this whole thing up. He says, surely Uncle Kevin can muster a force. And she replies that Uncle Kevin has the courage of a kitchen mouse. And he's like, well, then Jaime. She says he's off on a sensitive diplomatic mission. Again, just a reminder that just like Dany, Cersei's small council is like a chaotic mess right now. She just got nobody there. And that's when Littlefinger strikes. His whole plan comes down to this. He offers up the Knights of the Vale, says that they were trained to fight in the ice and the snow, says that he will take Winterfell for the crown, for Cersei, for Tommen, for the Lannisters.
Yep.
And he'll do that in exchange for being named Warden of the North after the fact. And Sansa's like, all right, you fuck. I see what you're getting at. I'll talk to Tommen this evening and he'll issue a royal decree. Littlefinger closes with, I'll not rest until the lion flies over Winterfell, which again is interesting because the lion is the Lannister sigil.
Mm-hmm.
Tommen, name is Baratheon.
Yep, again with this. Great point.
So it's,
I didn't even catch this one, and I'm always the one that brings it up.
Yeah, it's just it never stops.
Yeah. So, do you remember, because I do not, and if you don't, then we'll just let it play, but why does he end up siding with Sansa, Jon Snow? Why does he help them take care of the Boltons instead of just taking the whole shebang out? Is it because he can't, because he doesn't want to fight the wildlings and Jon Snow?
Sansa kind of calls in the favor on the basis of, hey, you gave me to this guy who brutally raped and abused me.
Okay.
I think is how it kind of, so then he sees the window as, okay, this thing has swung. I can still kind of accomplish what I want, which is to put Sansa in charge of Winterfell and then marry her or whatever. You know what I mean?
Right.
I think at the end of the day, he's just like, he's constantly keeping all the pieces in play.
Right.
to try to keep himself on the right trajectory, regardless of whatever else goes on. And we'll get to it. And I'm not exactly sure how that unfolded.
Yeah, was there something else that kind of played into it?
Sansa, I know Sansa for sure is the one that calls him into play.
Right.
And
yes,
he comes on her behalf. Yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
And okay. She doesn't even tell Jon Snow. There's that whole power struggle. But this thing with Cersei, I had completely forgotten that he even offered this up as a part of his little scheme. And it's just strange. And the hatred that Cersei carries for Sansa still is a little bizarre. Like no evidence or proof or any further evidence has nothing has come forward to prove that Sansa or Tyrion were involved in the murder of Joffrey. But like, while you can understand her lifelong hatred for Tyrion, because it's much more deep-seated and involves the death of her mother and their brother and sister, it's crazy she still wants to see Sansa's head on a spike. Like, she still holds her completely responsible for what happened. And Littlefinger is down to provide that. At least he's leading her to think so. In Dorne, Trystane Martell tells Myrcella Baratheon that he's going to ask his father if they can be married sooner rather than later. He doesn't want to wait. They appear to be very much in love. It should be noted, both Trystane and Myrcella are spelled with Ys. Interesting.
As is Miranda.
Uh-huh. Well, a lot of Y names in this one. Prince Doran watches on as these two lovers, young lovebirds, flirt and make out and such. And I guess he just sits there all day looking down at the water gardens. That's what Prince Doran, we literally never see him anywhere else.
Yeah, I guess. And all Trystane and Myrcella do are walk around the water gardens.
And yeah,
like
holding
so,
hands and such.
So much so that people in other parts of Westeros are like, I hear they like to hang out around the water gardens.
Everyone, all that's mentioned is the water gardens.
Yeah.
Ever.
Like, oh yeah, that's, I know where they are. They're at the water gardens.
At one point in a few minutes.
Like, is there nothing else to do in Dorne?
Yeah,
Jesus.
At one point in a few minutes when Jaime and Bronn are approaching, they're like, the water gardens. There they are. I see them. And I'm looking at the screen and I'm like, where? What the fuck are you talking about?
It's just the courtyard.
There's a whole landscape out there. It could be anything. It's just bizarre. But that linebacker of a bodyguard that Prince Doran has up there is watching with them. Doran says, a Lannister and a Martell, they have no idea how dangerous that is. We must protect them. And then he turns to his little bodyguard, and he's like, or big bodyguard, and he's like, you haven't used an axe in a long time. I hope you remember how. Which is kind of fucked up, just to like, what? I don't know. I just didn't really get the point of that. It's like, damn, dude, you calling out that he might be rusty? What, sharpen
well,
up?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know.
All they've been doing is standing there watching people gallivant around the water gardens for like a decade.
Well, because things have been good. But it's like, you know, if the Patriots have Jimmy G in there for a couple seasons, but Brady's still up on the sideline, and then Garoppolo goes down, Belichick's like, hey, Brady, you still know how to use that thing?
Yeah.
That's what would happen.
That's you're right.
You know,
right.
They're like, he's just asking.
He's getting a feel for it.
And it's a good question because guess what? He doesn't remember how to use it too well, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's it's not good for him. Next, we see Bronn singing a song about a Dornishman as he and Jaime ride in their new Dornish soldier costumes. They're going to sneak into the water gardens.
This scene gave me a great idea. Like, right along, I want these two. We need the reboot of Yo Mama with Wilmer Valderrama so that we can give more people the Cash Monies.
Uh-huh.
And then I need Bronn to star in a reboot of The Sound of Music.
Oh, that'd be good.
Yeah.
I would watch that.
He can be Captain Von Trapp.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I really would watch that, though.
Yeah,
I'm
that.
Not joking.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, they're going to... Bronn needs to know more about the plan. He's like, all right, so what? We all know about the water gardens. Everybody's heard about the water gardens. That part of the plan is very clear, Jaime. But what about after we get her out of the water gardens? And Jaime's like, oh, I like to improvise.
Call me Martha Stewart because I love to improvise. That's
and
what he says.
Bronn says, that explains the golden hand. Which, when you think about it for a little bit harder for a second, is exactly how Jaime got the golden hand. He tried to improvise his way out of a situation... And it led to him getting his fucking hand chopped off. So
he
just kind of
yeah.
like even more of a harsh takedown than Bronn might even be aware.
Mm-hmm.
Anywho. So then we see Ilaria Sand meeting with the Sand Snakes in secret. She says, unbowed, unbent, unbroken for Oberyn. And that's the name of the episode, obviously. And those are the words, the official words of House Martell. Unbowed, unbent, unbroken.
Ah.
Which is interesting because she's not part of House Martell. She's a Sand. And I get it. she carries that, you know, she's Oberyn Martell was her lover, her best friend, whatever. She's carrying the torch for him.
Sure.
Then the three little girls get masked up and they roll out. They sneak into the water gardens. Guess who's sneaking in at the same time? Jamie and Bronn. Jamie and Bronn are approaching Marcella and Trystane. Again, both have Y's in their names, and they're making out. And Bronn says, "Well, she's made herself at home," which is funny. And then they approach her. Jamie is like, hey, this whole interaction is very awkward. They like walk up out of nowhere wearing those costumes, and it's like, well, first of all, isn't that dude in a wheelchair and his big bodyguard watching? And they are, because this is what they do all day. And then she's making out with a dude in the corner, and they haven't seen each other in a long time. This is a little girl. And the guy is weird about it. Trystane. He just like introduces himself. He's not like, call the guards, or like whatever you should yell in this situation.
Uh-huh.
He tries to like control the situation like a man, kind of.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't work out. He's not like Oberyn level badass.
Right.
Not even near it.
No, he's a lover, not a fighter.
He is. And Oberyn was both. Anyway, this whole thing unfolds poorly for Trystane. Bronn tells him not to do anything stupid, and he immediately reaches for his sword and gets cold cocked in the face. Mm-hmm. He's like, that was something stupid. Jamie tries to convince Marcella to leave with him, grabs her by the wrist, and then suddenly out of nowhere, a whip snaps around his own wrist, and it's the Sand Snakes. This whole fight breaks out. It should be noted, one Sand Snake has a spear, one has a whip, and then one has two knives. And of all the dumb shit we make fun of with these chicks, their weapon choice is still the funniest. Absolutely outrageous. This is not the Ninja Turtles. Not everyone has to have a different weapon. You could all just have fucking swords. Why is one of them... It just doesn't make any sense.
They're very much like the Ninja Turtles.
They are.
What do they have again? One has a spear.
One has a whip.
Which is... Okay, no, not that
similar. See, it doesn't work.
No.
Leonardo, staff. Wait.
No, Donatello has a staff.
Leonardo swords.
Leonardo, two double swords.
Double dope ninja swords.
Yes. Raphael has the little tri-things.
They're like... They're called, what are they like, called? Oh man.
Katanas.
Raphael
katanas,
weapon,
right?
Ninja Turtles.
I think they're katanas. I don't know. And then Michelangelo nunchucks.
Oh man, I'm so close. Sai.
Okay.
Sai's. Yeah. S-A-I.
Sure.
And then, yeah, nunchucks. Which, look, if the whip, what are you, Indiana Jones? Should have gone with nunchucks or something. Gotta have something.
I always felt bad for Donatello because he always had to be the buzzkill.
Yeah.
And he just had a staff.
Yeah.
Like, nobody ever wanted to be Donatello.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense that Donatello would show up day one of Ninja Turtle training camp and see Leonardo with two swords, for instance, and not be like, hey, I feel like I'm at a disadvantage. Can I trade in this wooden stick for some of those sharp swords?
Yeah, something cooler.
Like,
they should have given him a better weapon because he was the least cool of the four. So to also have the worst weapon was really just unfair.
He's the least cool because he's the most responsible. That's how things work in our brains.
Yes,
like for me too. It's like, yeah, he was kind of the dickhead of the whole group because he just wanted to do what he was supposed to do and not the fun shit like eat pizza and like try to bang newscasters or whatever the rest of them were doing. We're a Ninja Turtles podcast now. Regardless, this whole thing unfolds. They're fighting. While the fight goes on, the one with the whip grabs Marcella because at one point, she finally figures out, like, hey, I'm not really doing anything here because I brought a whip to this fight. And she grabs Marcella. She attempts to flee, but then the big linebacker bodyguard runs up and he says, drop your weapons. And he has a bunch of other Dornish soldiers with him. Everyone drops their weapons, and Jamie kind of almost doesn't for a second. So the bodyguard puts his axe to Jamie's neck. And I guess what was supposed to be like a cool guy threat thing, he says, when you were whole, it would have been a good fight. And you have to remember, this bodyguard is supposed to be some legendary badass.
He's right up there with Barristan the Bold and Ser Jorah.
A Norvosi priest.
Yeah.
Is what he is. So he's very good. Anyway, the point is, he acknowledges, hey, Jamie, when you had two hands, this would have been like one for the singers to sing about. But
oh, yeah.
Nah, they're not, it doesn't, nobody cares. Bronn tells one of the Sand Snakes that she fights pretty good for a little girl, and that causes her to go apeshit. And that's not important other than to say that he has struck up a romance with her official.
Oh, yes. That's his little spicy mommy right there.
Oh, yeah. Oh, she's bad. She's a bad girl. We find out more about her and the bad parts of her later. And then we see Ilaria Sand get arrested by a bunch of Dornish soldiers as well. Then we're back in King's Landing, and guess who else has returned? It's Lady Olenna Tyrell. and she does not like that you can smell the shit in King's Landing from 5 miles away. Which I'm gonna take a dump on the Bourbon Street area of New Orleans here.
Okay, let's do it.
That's what I imagine King's Landing smells like throughout.
Oh yeah.
Right?
Oh yes. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Just to try to draw a comparison to somewhere I've been.
Yeah.
Bourbon Street smells terrible. She is there. Elena has returned to make sure that her grandson, Loris, the heir to her family, is freed. She notes, if they arrested all the pillow biters in King's Landing, there'd be no room left in the dungeons for anyone else. Renly Baratheon shagged half of the stable boys in the Seven Kingdoms. Everyone knew, no one cared. Basically, her argument is, everybody knew about Renly, and no one cared. Why is my grandson being punished unjustly for something that this other guy... She sees them as equals in the grand scheme of things and doesn't understand why one's being treated differently than the other. And so she goes to visit Cersei to meet with her because she knows Cersei is behind all of this, whether Cersei will admit it or not. And they have this biting back and forth. Cersei says, ah, yes, the famously tart-tongued Queen of Thorns. And Olenna's response is, and the famous tart, Queen Cersei... And I was like, Cersei, that gets her attention, Cersei. She stops what she's doing and finally looks up and is like, basically like, take that back.
Yep.
So I was like, what's tart mean? I Googled it.
Like a whore.
Like yeah, it's
promiscuous.
Like a slightly dumbed down, it's one step below outright saying you're a whore. It's like you're a really flirty tease, basically.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's if you were wondering. Cersei continues to play dumb like she had nothing to do with Loras's incarceration. Olenna starts to get a little more coy with her. She asks if the crown no longer has need for the gold and wheat that the Tyrell family is supplying them with. Back and forth they go. And then Cersei's like, look, none of this matters. There's going to be this hearing to see if there's any merit to the charges against Loras, and then he'll be freed because there won't be any merit to it, right? The next thing we see is that hearing. And the High Sparrow asks Loras about the rumors concerning Loras and Renly. He cites evidence from witnesses regarding their relationship. One of the... situations he brings up is how Loras, you know, refused to leave Renly's side after he was dead. That's kind of the extent of what they've gotten from third-party witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
Then Loras gets to talk, and he's like, look, Joffrey forgave me for fighting for Renly, and then I fought for Joffrey at the Battle of Blackwater, and the High Sparrow's like, ah, but you were wearing Renly's armor, and Loras is like, why the fuck does it matter what I was wearing? Back and forth they go. Then the High Sparrow lays out all the charges a little more formally: fornication, buggery, blasphemy. Loras denies them all, says he never laid with Renly Baratheon or any other men ever. Then, in a shocking move, the Faith calls Queen Margaery forward, says neither kings nor queens are exempt from testimony at a holy inquest. This whole time, Tommen just sitting there like a doofus, like, what am I supposed to do? The High Sparrow asks Margaery about all the charges brought against Loras, her brother. She swears in the presence of the gods, this is important, swears in the presence of the gods that her brother is innocent in all of the charges against him to the best of her knowledge, and then she's dismissed. Next, the Faith brings up, guess who? It's the blonde prostitute that has been running things for Littlefinger in his absence, that has been involved in every storyline somehow in King's Landing. And this blonde prostitute, male prostitute, he's also the one that Oberyn hung with, mm-hmm, and he's been all over the damn map. He testifies that he squired for Loras, that Loras took a liking to him and summoned him to his chambers the first day he met, which again, you have to remember, this was all Littlefinger who did all of this.
Yep.
He sent that blonde prostitute to go hang with Loras. Anyway, that night they lay together, engaged in intimate relations, that night and many others. Loras calls him a liar. The blonde dude says that Queen Margaery can support his claim that she once walked in on them not long ago and didn't seem surprised that they were together. And Cersei pipes in. She says, this testimony is an insult to a great house. Why should the Faith or anyone else take the word of a squire over the heir to Highgarden? She's just trying to play along here. And the blonde prostitute says that Loras has a birthmark quite high on his thigh, wine-colored and roughly the shape of Dorne, which is a callback to a totally unnecessary scene in which we see said birthmark, mm-hmm, and they converse over the shape and color of said birthmark.
Indeed.
And this birthmark thing is the one that hits Loras right in the heart, in the feelers. He lashes out. He tries to attack the witness, calls him a liar. And apparently, That was enough. The faith is satisfied. There is enough evidence to bring a formal trial for Sir Loras, .. and Queen Marjorie, which is like the big reveal here, that they're gonna try to go after the queen as well.
Yeah.
Because she just lied.
The High Sparrow, this old homophobe gay hater here.
Yeah. He's a gay basher.
Yeah, and I hated this scene because nothing good happens after this for anybody in that room, basically, except outside of Cersei.
Yeah, it's crazy. I think the entire room, aside from her, dies. Literally every single human being in there, even Olenna, when she's she's halfway across the world, but she still gets it.
Yeah.
Yeah, this all goes terribly wrong.
This is the end of the Tyrells, basically.
Yes. And it's crazy because it's such like a... I mean, when you're watching this, you're like, okay, surely they find a way out of this.
Right,
like,
yeah.
But no, that never happens. Nah. Like, you have to realize they never recover from this moment right here. This is fucking it. It's a good point.
Like, I personally blame Tommen.
Dude just sat there, man.
What you doing, though?
You would think... All right, like, I understand that he's a child and he's inexperienced and he doesn't really understand everything that's going on and his mom is a psychopath, but you would think that at the very least, as a kid who doesn't understand, you would be like, hey, fuck that, you can't do this.
Yeah.
You would yell or something or cause some kind of scene or maybe kill one guy unintentionally with a guard.
Well, and also, this is like where, like, you'd think that he would kind of snap and be like, I've got, like, 10 King's Guard, plus I can do whatever I want. I'm the king. I'm just going to go kill a bunch of people.
Yeah, like, that's my hot wife that you're locking up now. Yeah.
So now it's on and popping.
She lets me hit it 4 times back to back.
Yes.
Nah, this is not cool. Yeah. No, but he doesn't ever do that. In fact, this continues to be a frustration for several episodes to come. He has these, like, meetings with the High Sparrow while Marjorie's still locked up and shit, and you're just like, dude, what are you doing? Murder all of these people. And that's where... I'd never seen that angle of this show before, but the one where you look at what Joffrey would have done and you look at what Tommen's doing and you're like, which one would you pick?
Yeah.
And really, at the end of the day, you'd pick the psycho killing machine, Joffrey, because Tommen's just a little bitch. Anyway, this whole thing's a mess, though. And Marjorie's yelling Tommen's name as she gets dragged away and he just sits there. Olenna looks over at Cersei like, come on, bitch, really? And the whole thing is just, it's a fucking mess. Then, in Winterfell, we have a very joyous ending to this episode. It's a wedding. Sansa and Ramsay's wedding day. It starts off with Ramsay's girlfriend, Miranda, with a Y, visiting Sansa in her chambers. She says Lord Ramsay sent her to draw Sansa a bath. She says you want to be clean and fresh for your new husband, don't you? Which is creepy. And then she bathes her. For some reason, Sansa agrees to this, and while she's giving her a bath, she sweet-talks her. She says she's so beautiful, but she will need to keep Ramsay happy because he gets bored easily, and she doesn't want to end up like the others. This is like typical, if your girlfriend and your ex-girlfriend get into a conversation, your ex-girlfriend tries to, like, very intentionally, but, like, almost subconsciously, you know, destroy your relationship. That's what she's trying to do here. And she's bathing her, she's washing her hair. She says, it's good to see the red again. No point in hiding anymore, as she washes the black dye or whatever it is out of Sansa's hair. And then Miranda gets straight into it, starts telling Sansa all about these other women. First, Kyra, the blacksmith's daughter, who was tall like Sansa, had a lovely figure, but she talked too much, and Ramsay grew tired of that. Then there was Violet, gorgeous blonde hair, but she got pregnant, and, well, that was boring. Which I have to say, out of the 3 explanations we get for the reason these 3 other women were moved, the getting pregnant one is the most... I just thought she would have had more. She got pregnant, and, well, that was boring? That's it? That's what a bummer. Then there's Tansy, who's the one that we saw, engaging a threesome with Theon. Such a sweet girl. Of course, sweet girls get a bit dull after a while, don't they? Ramsay let me come with him on that hunt. And then Miranda asks Sansa if she's ever seen a body after the dogs have been at it. Not so pretty, she says. Sansa responds to this whole intimidation scheme very cool and calm and collected. She asks her what her name is again, and she says Miranda. And Sansa says, and how long have you loved him, Miranda? Did you imagine that he would be with you forever? Is that it? Then I came along and ruined it. I am Sansa Stark of Winterfell. This is my home, and you can't frighten me. It was the first kind of, like, really ballsy, powerful Sansa that we ever see, really. Mm. Like, ever. unfortunately, it
owning a situation.
Yeah, yeah. She's like, yeah. Fuck you. You can't just game me like that. Like, this is the first result of Littlefinger's tutelage that we see ever.
Right, right.
And unfortunately, it is followed up by something that breaks her down big time. But we do see, we start to see the strength that has come as a result of everything she's been through and being with Littlefinger and seeing how the game works and seeing how people try to manipulate each other. She outright says, like, fuck that, that's not working on me here. She finishes up her bath alone, puts on her wedding dress, and then Reek knocks at her door. He has come to escort her to the Godswood, to the wedding ceremony. He is all cleaned up for the wedding. He's in Theon mode here. And she refuses. She's like, fuck that, you're not touching me. He insists that she has to take his arm, that Ramsay will punish him if she doesn't. And Sansa's like, look, I don't care what he does to you, dude. Do you really think I care what he does to you? And then she just walks off by herself. Then we get to the wedding, which is at night. It's lit by torchlight. It's in the Godswood. Solemn music plays the whole time, so you know this is not going to end well. Reek leads Sansa up to the procession. The traditions begin. Reek acts as her father in the procession. When Ramsay asks who gives her, Reek says, Theon of House Greyjoy, who was her father's ward. And then there's a, like, at one point they ask Sansa, like, do you take this man? There's a long pause. She kind of goes through her whole part in the procession without a fight. And then she says, I take this man. And Ramsay smiles because he knows it is done. She is screwed. It is over. And the wedding ends. Back after the wedding, Sansa and Ramsay head to their new chambers. Candles are everywhere. It's very romantic. Ramsay asks, are you pleased, my lady? He's being very polite, very cordial. He says he wants to make her happy. And then he rips off the veil. He kind of removes the facade. He starts being real. And he says, my father said you're still a virgin. Why? Why are you still a virgin? Afraid of dwarves? And Sansa explains that Lord Tyrion never touched her. He says, you're not lying to me. Lying to your husband on his wedding night, that would be a bad way to start a marriage. We're man and wife now. We should be honest with each other, don't you think? And he kisses her. He says, good, take off your clothes. And she looks over at Reek, who turns to leave, and Ramsay says, oh, no, 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 you stay here, Reek, you watch. And that's when you realize, fuck, the gloves are coming off.
Yeah, he's going full Ramsay here.
He's really doing it. Reek stops and he stays, and Ramsay turns to Sansa again and says, do I need to ask a second time? I hate asking a second time. So Sansa turns away from Ramsay and starts to undress. Reek closes the bedroom door. Ramsay says, Reek, I told you to watch. You've known Sansa since she was a girl. Now watch her become a woman. And then all hell breaks loose. Ramsay comes at her from the back. He rips open her dress. And I don't know what you define this as, but it certainly isn't consensual sex.
Oh, it's rape. Yeah,
it's rape. And the episode closes on Reek's face, like just getting closer and closer to Reek's face as you have to watch the horror unfold through the emotions on his face while you're hearing the background noise of Sansa crying out, Ramsay grunting mm-hmm. is what the fucking subtitles say.
Right.
And it's just, it's up there with the five worst endings in Game of Thrones.
yeah.
It is. It's like a Red Wedding, Ned getting his head chopped off, this rape scene. There are not many that are more of a downer than this.
Yeah.
And having seen, I mean, because you have to give it to him. The wedding was beautiful. That's a great setting. She's got, it's all mm-hmm. in the Godswood. It's so bizarre to watch the Boltons. They do the whole song and dance of all of the traditions, like in the sight of the old gods, only to have it end in a rape, which just makes it all the more sick. It's like in the making Reek stay and watch thing. It's like, what? That's just to make it worse for Sansa, by the way. Reek's already broken down as far as he can go.
Right. Yes. Yeah, I agree. That's and I think, okay, so one thing that I hadn't remembered, I just was kind of like, I was actually looking into this episode to try to get more info on the House of Black and White, but this storyline is totally off book.
Yeah.
In case you did not know that. Sansa actually never marries Ramsay or is in Winterfell at this current time in the books.
Which is so crazy, and that's why people were so upset.
Yeah, and so that's one of the things that people were a little upset about is like basically like why this scene needed to happen. And like you just said, it shouldn't be because that's what Reek needs.
It's
to
not.
Like,
it's because Sansa. He's done. He's Reek.
He's done, yeah.
He's like, full Reek.
Well, and if there was going to be anything to snap him out of it, that shit already would have happened.
Yeah.
And so while this does happen to the character that does marry Ramsay in the books. I guess that's part of it. And then I guess they wanted to show the wedding night, and what else would Ramsay do except for be a horrible human about it?
I think it accomplishes the goal of getting Ramsay to the furthest instance of monster that you're going to see. You see Reek, he's full Reek. It's over for him. He'll do whatever he's told, whenever he's told. I think this sort of serves as a jumping off point for Reek to be like, I can't fucking do this anymore. Like, it's the first thing that spurs him toward, I have to do something to get this girl out of this spot. Mm-hmm. The way he sees it in his head is, he destroyed her family, right? After he was raised by her family. He feels very responsible for what happened to the Stark family. He has now watched her be raped by this man who has destroyed his life and completely taken him over and turned him into this monster of a pet or whatever you want to call it. And I think he finally gets like that flick, that little bit of light in his head here where he's like, someone has to do something about this situation for Sansa. And I'm the only one who could do it, and who better to do it? I get what they were going for. It's just so dark that it's like, fuck, right, man.
Well, and I don't think the reaction would have been as bad as it was in 2015 when this episode aired had Game of Thrones not already kind of fumbled over a couple of rape scenes.
The Jamie
Daenerys
Cersei
falls
one.
In love with her
rapist.
With her original rapist, and then the Jamie Cersei thing. So people were already kind of like, you know, squirmy about those two things,
right.
And then they did this one, and they were like, "Oh, god damn it!" Like,
well, and what you have to remember, and to Game of Thrones' defense, and it's like it feels weird defending this, but it's a story. It's none of this is real.
Sure.
None of this actually happened, first of all, so you can't be offended by it because it's fake. That's not how it works. If you're offended by something fake, you just don't watch the fake thing because you don't have to because it's not real. The Danny Khal Drogo deal. That's how that would have unfolded. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, it's not unrealistic. This scene isn't unrealistic either to me. And that's, if it was unrealistic, if you were like, this would never happen.
Yeah.
That's when I think it's okay to be offended, because it's like, they're just doing this for the sake of being nasty or whatever. That's not the case here. This guy's a fucking monster.
Well, that's kind of why I, especially on this rewatch, didn't really like have an issue.
Yeah,
with,
I didn't feel it at all.
With them going there. Because.
Right.
That's what Ramsay would have done.
And it's the number one motivating factor.
I don't
for
know why. He wasn't going to be like a nice person about the wedding night sex with Sansa.
It was, you were going to have to allude to
so
this in one way or the
right,
other.
Yes. Yes.
And this was probably the most effective way of not, it's like, if you weren't already full-fledged terrified for Sansa and how she was going to get out of this, now you are.
Right.
You realize, oh my God, this guy's going to horribly mistreat her. She's in a very, very bad spot.
Yeah. In case you thought that maybe Ramsay would like take this
treat
slow
her well
or like try to kind of hide the monster inside
from
her.
Because he had been.
Yeah.
He had acted like a regular gentleman up until this point with her in front of her, and then he rips it all down. Which is to let you know, this guy's not going to fuck around anymore. Once he has her locked down as his wife, he feels he can do whatever he wants. And the whole thing you also have to remember is that Sansa uses all of the horrid shit that happens to her to become who she is later on in the story. That's the important takeaway, is none of this breaks her or beats her, even if it does temporarily.
Sure.
Like, long, big picture, it does not at all. It sucks ass to watch, but it is part of the story. It is what it is. We will be back next Monday to talk about the 7th episode of season 5, The Gift, written by Benioff and Weiss and directed by Miguel Sapochnik. You can follow our podcast on Instagram at Oysters Clams Cockles, also on Twitter at Clams and Cockles. We're also on Facebook.com/OystersClamsCockles. You can follow me, Ross Bolin, at WR Bolin, BOLEN, on Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. I also have a comedy podcast called the Ross Bolin Podcast, which comes out a couple times a week. I suggest you subscribe to that on iTunes if you want to laugh or whatever. Barrett, where can everybody follow you and give us a rundown on Cool
while,
Club?
While your
Club
podcast
cool
is funny, it's really just, it's an entertainment podcast.
It really
I mean,
is.
It's funny, but it's entertaining,
sure.
Not just comedic.
No, yeah, sure.
You learn stuff, too.
Sure.
Yeah. You can follow my personal accounts on Twitter and Instagram at Barrett Dudley. I'm wearing a Hawaiian shirt today. And on V4 of my new podcast, Club Cool, which you can find on Grand X Labs, we give our takes on the current state of the Hawaiian shirt, offering valuable insight, advice, and thoughts on the trend, on the clothing item itself. So, you know, if that's something that would interest you, check out Club Cool. It's my new style, fashion, and pop culture podcast. It's on Grand X Labs. You can follow it on Instagram and Twitter at Club Cool Pod.
How about that? How about all that info? You love that shit, don't you? Hotline number 866-43-CLAMS. Hey, if you're enjoying the Knights Rewatch, if you love oysters, clams, and cockles, especially leading up to season 8, every review, every rating we can get from you guys counts big time. So if you're subscribed on Apple Podcasts, if you haven't subscribed, first of all, obviously subscribe, but go on there, type in oysters, clams, and cockles, take a few seconds, literally it takes 20 seconds if you're super speedy, 5-star rating, and write a quick review. Means the world to us. You can also go to grandxshop.com/OCC if you want to get oysters, clams, and cockles and Game of Thrones themed t-shirts, including the shirt that was promised. If you have not grabbed yours already, it is readily available. grandxshop.com/OCC. We will be back next time.